In gold rushes in the past, prospective miners traveled for months to reach a site. In the future, they might do it again, because there was gold in them there asteroids. So today, we return to the Outward Bound series to look at Ceres and the rest of the asteroid belt. Sort of like when we looked at colonizing Jupiter and Saturn, where the planet itself is not where most of the people live, but on the smaller objects nearby, our focus today won't be entirely on Ceres, though with one key difference, as we'll see, Ceres is likely to be where folks tend to live or visit, but not where a lot of the people actually walk. This is a good point to address earlier on, though. We always say the asteroid belt, referring to a swarm of smaller objects, unlike how we'd refer to Jupiter and its moons. But in some ways, while Ceres is not central to the asteroid belt the way a planet is to its moons, it's better to think of that whole asteroid belt as focused around Ceres. There may be millions of asteroids in the belt, but Ceres makes up about a third of the mass. To match its size, you need to include the next dozen biggest asteroids, leaving the remaining third of the belt's mass to be distributed among its remaining millions of members. Even then, while we always warn people not to think of the asteroid belt as a dense place you'd have to dodge around, a lot of the belt is composed of asteroid families, often centering on a larger asteroid, and some, like Sylvia, the eighth largest asteroid, even have moons. Fairly impressive ones, too, from a visual perspective. Some small rock a few kilometers across is fairly impressive when it's only a few hundred kilometers away, and from the surface of such a tiny moon, its parent asteroid would dominate the sky more than Jupiter does to the Galilean moons, and the gravity is so weak you could jump off and float there. The weak gravity is a big issue for colonization, too. Even the biggest ones have escape velocities so low, you could shoot a gun and the bullet would never land, and a baseball tossed upwards would take many minutes to land. On the smaller ones, you'd float off into space just by trying to take a step. We've talked about enhancing gravity on larger moons or places like Mars and Mercury by using a large bowl or vase-shaped habitat, which could spin around, combining centrifugal force with regular gravity. But even on the largest asteroid, Ceres, such things are fairly redundant. A cylinder set on the surface, with its axis of rotation parallel to gravity, would just have a slow creep towards the bottom you could manage with some minor sloping or walls. One turned perpendicular to gravity would simply result in gravity feeling a little higher when your feet were pointing down, and a little lower when you were upside down. For that perpendicular version, on Ceres, where gravity is 3% of Earth's, if you weighed 100 pounds and stood on a scale, you could watch it slide from 97 to 103 as you spun. Almost anywhere besides Ceres and those handful of largest asteroids, you wouldn't be able to notice. It's a big place in some ways. Ceres, again, is a full third of the belt's mass. And yet Earth's moon is about 80 times more massive than Ceres, and in turn, the Earth is about 80 times more massive than the moon. We talk about exploiting the resources of the belt. Indeed, we've done a whole episode on asteroid mining, and yet every single asteroid combined has only 1% of the mass and resources of Mercury, the last place we visited in the series and spoke of mining for resources. So what is the attraction of the belt? Traditionally in this series, we followed a storyline of a traveler visiting place after place as we colonized them. We left the traveler out in Alpha Centauri, but let's join an aspiring asteroid miner on their way to Ceres, not to be the first to land and plant a flag, not for great honor or prestige, but just to make a living. The half-year trip from Earth was long and uncomfortable, but our ship has finally arrived at Ceres and will land in Akator, a vast crater almost 100 kilometers across, dotted with dark-tinted domes showing a bit of green shade and roving tractors, scooping up ammonia-rich clays for nitrogen and the other deposits rich in sodium carbonate, magnesium, and sulfates. Water ice is quite plentiful on Ceres, as everyone knows, but as we get on the crawler with some of our shipmates for the trip from the landing site to the main base, one of them points out that what makes Ceres so nice as a port of call is that it has an awful lot of what we need for life. We came out here to do some mining, but he did not. He spent all his funds on his ticket and a box full of seeds and microbial cultures. He's renting a whole small dome from the Akator company, the biggest consortium on Ceres, and the one that runs this crater and base. He's going to start growing blueberries, the first blueberries in the belt, and selling them to hungry miners and base personnel who are particularly eager for something fresh. Food is a big industry on Ceres. The domes are tinted to keep out more harmful frequencies and help keep in heat. This surprises us, though, as we all fall from the sun. Surely plants can't grow here. But he gestures around and points out it isn't dim at all. Even way out at Pluto, the daylight is as bright as a cloudy day on Earth. See, light's a tricky thing, and our eyes don't really realize that the light of the noontime sun is carrying a million times more photons to our eyes compared to what the moon does at night, and a thousand times what we tend to think of as comfortable indoor lighting. The asteroid belt is farther from the sun, with most of the asteroids between twice and thrice as far away as Earth, but also has no air interfering with light reaching the ground or filtering out harmful parts of the spectrum. So lighting in the belt can range from nearly a quarter what it is at Earth's equator to as little as 10% in the outer parts of it. Our companion tells us that between the dome filtering and the latitude here at Akator Crater, the dome gets a peak illumination of 10,000 lux. A lux, one lumen per square meter, is how bright stuff is in the visible range of light, which is more or less the ones plants use, even though they do best with boosts to red light. Very approximately, 1 watt per square meter of visible light is 125 lux, and it's about what we find comfortably bright indoor lighting. Plants fall into 4 loose lighting types: low, medium, high, and very high. They can often live, but be slow growing and weak, at as little as 10% of their preferred lighting. So you can grow anything under the sunlight anywhere in the belt, even its outer reaches. However, many hardly need that much light. Low-light plants are 500 to 2500 lux, medium is 2500 to 10,000, high is 10 to 20,000, and very high is 20 to 50,000. Here at Ceres, in the middle of the belt, any of these first three categories do just fine, and the very high category can be accommodated by just having some LED lights in the red range boosting things a bit. The domes are very insulated to keep heat in because it's still quite cold here and we need to keep the domes warm. Plants tend to like it warmer than people too, so every insulation trick has been used to cut down on the energy needed. Akator is a big company, the biggest located only in the belt, but still not big and rich enough to afford a fusion reactor in these early days of colonization. So they use fission and solar, and have big pipes running around the crater, carrying steam off from the reactors and running back through when it condenses back to water. This helps warm the domes. Some of that power runs through mineral processing and manufacturing, some supplemental red lighting for the growth domes, some for human comforts, but a lot is for the big fettling gun, a mass driver stretching around the crater rim wall that smaller ships can race around and get some speed up to launch into space. Racing around that, clutching onto a small but sturdy rail, they can build up to 1400 meters per second at 4 g's of acceleration before letting go to sail off around the belt. We ask a technician why it's called the Big Fettling Gun. He replies that fettling is trimming the rough edges off a piece of metal, or in this case, a spacecraft. If the craft is falling apart or things aren't strapped down, the crew finds out the hard way when they get slung. That and the abbreviation BFG, he smokes. Another of our companions is going to walk on the launcher and tells us how much fuel it saves. Big ships, like the one we came in on, with their own reactors, don't use it or need to, but for small ships or drones, it's a big deal. One of our other companions is here to work in the entertainment industry, and that's a big industry here too. Of course, all the TV and virtual reality comes straight from Earth, other than the Belt News Network, but there's a lot of call for recreation. Tourism from Earth isn't too common, but folks spend a lot of time cramped on board ships, and often come home to Ceres with lots of money to spend on leave. Such services vary a lot, from the cheap to the expensive, the wholesome to the downright indecent. If you've seen one extraterrestrial entertainment precinct, you've seen them all, and we're neither much interested in that, and nor is our meager bank balance. And that is a key point. Most of our companions are planning on living here. out of the whole arriving group, we seem to be the only minor, although even most of the minors already in the belt live here when they're not out prospecting and mining. One of our companions objects and says she's going to be mining too, just here on Ceres. But she doesn't mean mining the dwarf planet itself, though that is a common enough occupation. She runs drones, small packages of not much more than some sensors and guidance. They fly off, make a close pass on an asteroid, take some readings and photos, and do a small course correction to the next one. The thing about the belt is that everything is sort of meandering around on its own trajectory, and except for the asteroid families that tend to huddle up a bit, your neighbors are constantly changing. Not everything orbits on the same path or period, so it is a big ever-shifting cloud. If one asteroid gets mined out near Ceres, another will eventually enter the area too. She'll be keeping track of hundreds of drones, and doing forced analysis for signs of a rich strike. Our bank account is mighty thin, but we still make sure to buy her a drink before heading off to our temporary quarters here. That, and most areas meant for people, are deep underground, and we'll be staying in a cheap, small, rotating cylinder block with marginal gravity, and where the floor isn't quite lined up with the direction of that gravity. It's minor, but when we spill a glass of juice, we can watch the puddle creep under our bed. Standing up in a hurry or moving quickly are also nauseating experiences, as the changes in perceived gravity are easily picked up by our inner ear. We decide that we'll want to upgrade to someplace nicer as soon as possible. For the moment, our goal is to get on board a mining ship, and it doesn't take us long to find out where the crews hang out when on shore leave. Unsurprisingly, it is in the less wholesome and more expensive portions of the station. The crews are easy to spot because a lot of them sport precious metals as jewelry. Out here mining for gold and platinum, apparently the jewelry shows one is a miner, and a successful one will sport a lot of bling. We figured a lot of openings would be free, from folks coming home after making their fortune, but to our surprise, not so much. Many inquiries we make are waved aside by miners trying to unwind after long stints in space and not wanting to talk business, especially the ones from crews who just struck a big find and are not yet interested in looking for the next. We thought these would have plenty of open slots, folks heading home, but we start noticing that when we say home, most think you're referring to their place here in Akator, not Earth. A ride to Earth takes a long time, costs a lot of money, and luxuries are getting more common here for those who can afford them. Many see no reason to return to Earth. Most of the folks on Ceres aren't miners. They work in other trades and provide other services. But miners do seem to be the default job here, and again, are easy to spot by all the bling they wear. After a week, we have reached a dangerously low bank balance. We finally find a ship's captain who is almost willing to bring us on board, but declines. Fortunately for us, our friend from the drone department is in a celebratory mood from finding a pair of nice promising strikes, and lets us know about the one she forgot to record, a smaller one that can be chalked up to a distraction. It turns out, this sort of thing is fairly common here in Akator, and she agrees to give the captain coordinates for it, in exchange for some reciprocation. We sigh a bit, disappointed that people are people everywhere, even here on the hopeful frontier of humanity, but we're not going to complain. It gives us a slot on the ship and a share of the claim. No pay, though, just room and board and a share, a historically common practice. We head out, and our ship is a decent-sized one, home to a dozen crew, of which we are the most junior and, unsurprisingly, stuck with the least fun jobs. We also assumed spaceships would be a lot nicer and more high-tech, and the ship we came out on was a bit of a letdown. But the mining vessel, the good ship Rockhopper, looks like it was clapped together in someone's garage. One upside about moving around the belt is it doesn't take the cream of the crop to design, build, or maintain a ship meant for use only in the belt. It doesn't have or need any fission reactor. We'll be buying fuel here on Ceres where it's made, along with most of our supplies. But first, we have to buy mining rights on the small metallic asteroid a week's travel away. We will be doing all that through the Akator company, but the rights are actually held back on Earth, some bizarre and labyrinthine treaty that requires a fee and a share of any spoils that gets divided up by all the countries back on Earth. So we pray to whatever mining gods might be listening that the rock hopper is stronger than it looks as we go off, whirling around on rock hopper in Aquator Crater's big Fetling gun. Mercifully, we survive with a few metallic groans and bits of equipment that haven't been properly stowed smacking into the bulkheads, but we're off to space. Quarters are cramped, nothing seems clean, and the food is all packaged stuff because the ship is too small to bother with spin gravity or its own hydroponics. The captain says nicer ships have extending sections that can provide gravity during flights or when the ship settles into an asteroid to mine, but not the rock hopper, which literally has duct tape holding components together. But we do get there and shoot a bunch of harpoons into the asteroid and winch the ship up against it, inside a nice crater next to our find. We don't walk out, because there's just no gravity, and because we have our own drones to fly over and look. It's a good chunk of minerals, rich in gold, and when we start going EVA and poking around, we find there's tons of it deeper down. Indeed, there's more than we have fuel to find down and send back to Earth directly, or take on board the ship to fly back. The captain decides that in order to find out just how much there is, we'll do some mining and refining. We are going to settle in for a while, and decide to erect a dome over the ship, so we pop up an inflatable dome. The nice thing about microgravity is even a thin sheet of plastic won't break under the weight of whole boulders. We pressurize that area so we can walk without suits, and get to work. As an added precaution against micrometeor strikes, we cover the plastic in pycrete, and then cover it more with soil we dig up. Pycrete is basically frozen water plus some fibrous material. It's sturdy enough to hold air in, and being opaque, makes it hard for anyone to see what we've found. Pycrete's handy stuff in space. It's much tougher than ice, and while not permanent, it's easy to make and lasts more than enough time for what we need it for. We have a pod on board, and we fuel it up and send it to Earth on the slowest trajectory. The captain says it's already sold. Not a great price, though. The company buying it is getting a good price because it won't get home for years, and it has security and fraud concerns. The money is handy, though, because it can get a remote cargo pod sent off to us, with some supplies and fuel, so we can keep walking. It doesn't take much fuel to go from the belt to Earth's orbit, especially if you don't mind it taking years, and precious metals on their way are almost as valuable as ones already in your vaults. We never do finish, though. Once the ship is loaded to capacity, we head back. Same as we sold the gold we refined years before it will get home, the captain sells the whole asteroid claim, with its documented mineral wealth, and notes that more undocumented materials may be there too. We didn't get as much as if we walked it ourselves, but we also don't have to worry about guarding it from claim jumpers or outright pirates. Stealth may be impossible in space, but that only applies to the ability to actually hide, not to someone bribing the folks who watch claims not to alert us. And Aquator on Ceres is not the most honorable place. Its rivals in other craters, or other major asteroids, probably aren't any better. Back on Aquator Station, we are very wealthy now. You might normally go many missions without finding a good strike, even with the probes doing advanced looks, but all it takes is one good one to make you phenomenally rich. Even after the loss, from selling most of it at a fraction of its real value, even after the bribes and taxes, and even being the junior-most crew member with the smallest share, we are quite rich and can easily afford a nice fast trip home to Earth. But the next one leaving isn't for a few days, and we've barely been here for a couple months, only a week on Ceres, and several on the rock hopper. We spent months getting out here. There's a lot going on here, so we just can't bring ourselves to leave yet. No rush, we'll take another ship back. We're getting a bit restless and thinking about leaving again when we bump into the captain, who is not going home and in fact buying a new and nicer ship, to be christened the Lucky Strike. He invites us to join the crew with a bigger share, nicer quarters, and more seniority, and we do. And the next thing we know, it's been a few years, and while we've never had another strike like the first one, we've done pretty well down the years, and eventually buy our own ship to captain, which we dubbed the Rock Hopper 2, the original long since sold for scrap after it finally broke apart during a BFG sling. We've never gone home to Earth, but Ceres is home now. And indeed, we've got a place there where we stay when not out prospecting. We even bought a share in our friend's expanding blueberry business. Ceres is growing quite well, and more people come in every day. What's interesting is that more and more folks are just stopping in for a while to buy supplies and refuel for elsewhere in the belt, or the long haul to new colonies on Jupiter's moons. We bump into one traveler en route to Callisto, and after talking to them, we start seeing whole new possibilities for the belt. All those asteroids being mined out mostly leave some sort of infrastructure in place. Folks move on when the main mineral strike gets dug out, but a lot of folks are increasingly setting up protracted operations on these. What's more, it's always handy to have smaller outposts around, and while there's a lot of fast money on shipping precious metals back to Earth, a lot more folks are going into mining and manufacture of more mundane stuff, and agriculture. Many of those old mining sites are getting smaller cylinder habs installed in them, and becoming small communities. They are close enough to get quick signals back to Ceres, or even Earth, but they can't get a ship to Ceres or one of the other major asteroid colonies like Vesta fast. A ship carrying goods, just a remote drone in many cases, can get supplies to them though, and Akator is increasingly becoming a company involved in shipping goods out to those, the Amazon of the asteroid belt. At first, we wonder how long before such things drop off. But even ignoring that vast supplies of valuable minerals lie still untouched out there, we realize that even though the Earth has thousands of times the mass of the whole belt, it actually hasn't got nearly as much living area. So, using our wealth and our contacts with other miners, we open up a new business, buying up asteroids with depleted, excavated deep mines. Folks are bemused. Why would you buy up depleted claims? We explain that one little asteroid, only a kilometer across, of which there are nearly a million, can house a small O'Neill cylinder. Those, even the smaller versions, can house tens of thousands of people easily. With a million such asteroids, each supporting a cylinder habitat inside them, each housing tens of thousands, or tens of billions of people total, versus 7 billion back on Earth. Most of the hard work has already been done for us, because the miners subtracted material from inside the asteroid, mined it out, and without much more work, we are now putting hollow cylinders in it. We are not shipping most of that mass anywhere. We can make a very large cylinder, or network of cylinders, inside an asteroid that's been slowly hollowed out during mining. All we need to do is dump the spill outside of it. A typical kilometer diameter asteroid contains around a gigaton, enough material for a full-sized O'Neill cylinder, the kind 8 kilometers across and 32 kilometers long, and able to house a million people comfortably, albeit that cylinder would be thinner than I'd like, but protected by the walls of the asteroid from radiation and meteor strikes. While a majority of asteroids are in this size range, the majority of raw materials in the belt are not. You could get a billion full-sized O'Neill cylinders out there, each with a million folks. That's a quadrillion people, and that is without stretching any comforts or pushing the envelope on food production. You don't have to bring those any closer to the sun, either. Even sunlight can be concentrated by having mirrors nearby, which would be quite thin, though you could bring them either nearer to the Earth or Mars or in between them. See that episode, O'Neill Cylinders, for more discussion on the topic. Others are discussing other options for the belt. They want to move asteroids and bring them or megastructures made from them nearer Earth. Another idea is to bring Ceres closer to Mars, much closer than our own moon is to Earth, but still well above where you'd be keeping Martian orbital infrastructure, even long space elevators. That might be pretty, Mars' own moons being rather tiny and uninteresting, but more importantly, could be used to generate tidal forces and maybe get the inner core of Mars spinning up again for a decent magnetosphere and warm the place up a bit to release some much-needed gases into the atmosphere. This is quite a big project compared to our plans, but small compared to many we've discussed on this channel. As an aside, it would be a bit silly for me to say it's hard to move something just a percent of Earth's mass around when we've discussed moving Earth or even the whole solar system before. but discussing building big habitats inside asteroids or moving them large distances brings up the notion of interstellar travel, too. Any good space station can be made a spaceship, too, and the belt is a good place to make spaceships at. All the more so, since while the belt is far from the sun, a fairly developed asteroid colony will likely have lasers for pushing ships around inside the belt all over the place, not to mention dealing with debris hazards and meteors, and lasers are a nice way to give a ship some free speed without the mass of extra fuel. We'll be talking about that more in next week's episode as we get into generation ships, vessels meant for getting us out to the stars, something we'll be looking at a lot in the coming months. But before we can settle other star systems, we need to settle our own first, and the asteroid belt is likely to be a big factor, and Ceres is probably the best focal point for doing that. For our aspiring asteroid miner on their way to Ceres, the cheapest way will always be by the Interplanetary Transport Network, a series of slow but low-energy transfer maneuvers that are essentially the trade winds and currents of the solar system. The key to understanding those is the Hohmann transfer orbit, and if you want to learn more about that, then I recommend that you check out brilliant.org. You'll learn about the physics by breaking the problem down into relevant concepts, thinking clearly through each part, and then building it back up to the conclusion. This approach to problem solving is extremely crucial for the asteroid miner, as it allows them to figure out what to do when faced with novel situations in the mining and O'Neill cylinder business. If you want to learn how to quickly understand the depths of everything an asteroid miner would need to know, then go to brilliant.org/IsaacArthur and sign up for free. And also, the first 200 people that go to that link will get 20% off the annual premium subscription. That's the subscription I've been using to build up my own problem-solving skills. As mentioned, we'll be discussing generation ships a lot for the next few months, and we'll be beginning next week with an overview of the basic topics and talking about the key aspects of how to manufacture them and why you might use this approach over some other approaches for settling the galaxy, along with looking at some fictional examples of them, such as our book of the month, Arthur C. Clarke's classic novel, Rendezvous with Rama, which is a type of O'Neill cylinder itself. The week after that, we'll be teaming up again with John Michael Godier for a two-part look at what the galaxy might be like after we colonized it, if we encountered no aliens as we colonized the galaxy, or at least no civilizations that naturally occurred on their own. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel, and if you enjoyed this episode, please like it and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great week.